Talk given Friday evening, March 26th, 1976. We must ask, is it at all possible for any one individual in the world to be exclusively self-concerned? That is to say, he might be self-preoccupied in his mind constantly. He might be, as the bulk of human beings are, self-centered, selfish, and so on. But is it possible for him at all to cut himself adrift from the world? In the real sense of cutting adrift. Our very existence, from moment to moment, depends upon the existence of what we call the environment, the world, what we call the not-self. How then can the criticism leveled against the religious that he is selfishly concerned with his personal salvation and is insensitive to the sorrow, the trouble, the misery of the world? It can't be done. The person and the world are constantly interacting with each other, whether on the one hand the person wishes to interact or not, or the world wishes to interact with the person or not. This is a fact of our existence. We are in constant interplay. The difference comes in here that the person who interplays fully sensitive to the fact of his constant relationship with the world is the person who is likely to be an asset to mankind. And incidentally, consequentially, if he is an asset to mankind, an asset to himself too. Which means that what is called his progress and development can go on. Now, we all know that our modern world is coming to, I should say has come to, quite a serious pass. It is unquestionably moving towards a situation where it can destroy perhaps itself, or at least some of the fine achievements over the centuries. And this applies not merely to any one part of the world, Western or Eastern or Northern or Southern. It applies to the whole world. Everywhere we see violence, everywhere we see fear, mistrust, suspicion, secret counteractivities contradicting what is put forth openly and externally as a matter of diplomacy, regarding friendly relations and so forth. That is bad enough in itself. But there is another really terrible factor. The vast majority of the people of the world are apathetic. They are playing ostrich. They are deliberately shutting their eyes to the world situation. And they think, with regard to their own situation, their own personal life, that they are doing what is needful, they are jogging along, and are reasonably happy and well off, and so on. Now this is a very reprehensible unawakenedness in people. And we must realize that when we talk of the world, when we think about the world, we are not thinking, we should not be thinking of the other fellow being like that. We should also be fully awake to the fact that I am like that. This is very important. It is a natural human tendency to ascribe what is good to oneself, to excuse oneself most easily for faults, for wrongdoing, for sins of commission as well as of omission, and to shift the blame onto somebody else's shoulder. But since the beginning of time, man has never really succeeded in shifting the blame onto the other person's shoulder. He may point the finger of blame to the other person, but for his own mistaken way of life, for his own actual wrongdoing, he himself is caught up in the consequences of his thought and his action. He can't escape it. To compensate for what he may have to suffer, he invents countermeasures. And amongst these countermeasures, the pursuit of pleasure, the organizing of ways and means to be happy, as it is called, have multiplied terribly. And the surest way to be unhappy is to deliberately pursue thought out pleasures, sensational delights. And if we don't do it consciously, there is this unconscious drive in us to this craving for sensational delights, because we are ignorant of, on the one hand, the true nature of happiness and the true nature of our own self and the purpose of our existence in the world and how to fulfill that purpose. There is another point. There are thousands of well-meaning people. There are probably scores of thousands of them, maybe millions, in a population of 4,000 million in the whole world. And of these, a great many are anxious to do something positive, as it is called, in order to stem the tide of ill and somehow or other help the world to be put right. Now, you will notice that in practically every single field of human activity along these lines, not only now but throughout the world's history, this wanting to put the world right is thought of and exercised in practice in terms of inventing another system, another ideology, another technique, which is always external to the individual himself, to his own individual being. Superficially thoughtful people, even very thoughtful people and people with insight, superficially they will agree that the roots of ill lie in our own ignorance, our own pleasure lust, our greeds, our possessiveness, our self-esteem, egoism, vanity, and violence, and this complete imprisonment within the consciousness of self and the world in terms of a duality. This consciousness of all existence in terms of duality, the self and the not-self, the other fellow and myself. I have nothing to do with that. That is his business, sort of thing. And of course the perverted expression of the contrary is meddling with other people's business. See? Now, although a great part thoughtful people will give an intellectual assent that this is the root cause, my own greed, my own hate, my own fears and violence and ignorance and illusions and delusions and fixed ideas and beliefs and so on, that is the root of the trouble. I do nothing or hardly anything to understand this and be healed of this disease within myself. Note carefully, I'm not saying get rid of the disease. When you get rid of disease, all that you attempt is a countermeasure. And sometimes the cure is worse than the method of cure is worse than the pain of the disease. Not get rid of it, because that introduces conflict. Not understanding. Understanding, real understanding, heals, makes whole. Because we must always remember that there is nothing that we can throw out of the cosmos. If I get rid of something which I don't like or which is not good for me, as I say, I've thrown it somewhere else into the world. And the so-called somewhere else in the world is actually part and parcel of the place in which I myself am living. So it's no good doing that. My business is to understand it fully and accept it fully within my own psyche. And in that process, I transform the energy of life which is expressed in terms of this ill, this unvirtuousness. I transform the expression of that energy from its unvirtuous expression into the transcendentally virtuous state, not the relatively virtuous state, the enclosed within the sphere of ambivalence, good, bad, pleasant, unpleasant, success, failure, love, hate, kindness, cruelty, and all that. You are clean out of that state altogether. You have actually transformed your life energy into an unfailingly, rightly manifesting and functioning energy. This is what we have to bear in mind with respect to oneself. My part in the world. This is the whole meaning and significance of the religious life. Whatever shape and form that religious life may take, if it is truly religious, of yoga, of mysticism, of any of the so-called techniques that one may attempt to follow for living the good life in the true and profound sense of the word, the good life. So much with respect to oneself. But we all know that we are constantly interacting with our environment. And each one of us, as an individual, is a free individual in the sense that the uniqueness of the self is a sanctum which no one should try to invade, or even can invade. This withinness, this inwardness of the individual living human being is absolutely sacrosanct. Therefore, one should realize that however perfect and wonderful and right my ideas may be, my own achievements in terms of realizing human perfection and liberation may be, I have not the slightest right to impose those ideas upon another or compel another. How often I have said, transcendence, God, never compels. The irresistible, attractive power of divinity, which draws us towards fruition, is because of divinity embodied within us. But it remains silent, quiet, non-compelling. And because it is silent and quiet and non-compelling, therefore it remains absolutely unsullied divinity. And therefore, it is the permanent potentiality for me, myself, which can enable me, the external psychophysical person, so to observe and consider and live according to what I observe and consider, so that I am the perfect vehicle through which that divinity will shine forth and manifest. It is very, very hard to see this. We may get attracted if a person presents it in a lucid form, in an attractive form, and so forth. But beware of getting attracted by it. Because wheresoever that is the phenomenon of attraction, there will be hidden within it the phenomenon of repulsion. And vice versa. Haven't you noticed in your own life, again and again, when you meet somebody and you dislike that person, you may, if circumstances so work, you may end up by liking that person very much. And time and again, when they are of opposite persons, of opposite sexes, I mean, the two get married, which is quite unexpected, as we say. You start by saying, oh my goodness, I could never have anything to do with that man or that woman, as the case may be. And those are the very two people who will mate up for life. So, no compulsion whatsoever. This is important. There is a compulsion we all exert without any choice in the matter by the simple fact of our existence. You know, I have pointed out, suggested this wonderful thing about the planet on which we live, and the sun. The sun just shines. The sun is just itself. Vast hydrogen explosions, nuclear explosions constantly take place on the sun, and lo and behold, Mother Earth finds sustenance from it, and we all exist because of that. Heat and light and all sorts of radiations which are life-sustaining and so forth. And they are also life-destroying, unless there were all sorts of wonderful safeguards which the universe bestows upon us to live through all those radiations. So you see, the sun doesn't say, oh, I must do this, that and the other for the Earth or for Jupiter or for or Neptune or something. No, the sun doesn't say anything. It just is itself. Now, we have to be like that. The very fact of our existence, the very fact of being ourself, in the profoundest and truest sense of the word, self, you see, means that we are exerting an influence without our knowing it. No deliberate exertion. Without our knowing it, we are exerting an influence for good upon the ill state of the world. Now, of course, that presupposes, up to a point, that you and I, as we are, we do know the purpose of our existence. We have realized profound things. We are purified in mind and heart, and live truly human, which means truly holy lives. It presupposes that up to a point. And let us grant that that were the case. Now, remember, we cannot thrust our divinity down anybody else's throat. That we are agreed upon. Our influence is exerted by the fact of what we are. Now let us look at this question. Where does the ill of the world start? Every person, every event, situation, every object, every phenomenon conditions every single human being from the moment he is born. There is a conditioning influence. No one can escape being conditioned. And no one can escape conditioning his environment, which includes other people, by virtue of the fact of his own existence in the world. All right. Where does the evil start? Whose influence is the most powerful influence upon the newborn infant? Is it not the mothers of the world? And next to the mothers, the fathers of the world? Are not the instruments of motherhood and fatherhood the most powerful conditioning influences? Now, if the influences of mother and father, to start with, are happy influences, happy, not merely sensationally delightful. The infant, of course, will experience them to start with as sensational delight. Unquestionably, it will be there. But if the influence for true happiness from the intelligent understanding, capable mother and father were present upon the child to start with, then we have perhaps the best possible chance of seeing a different condition for all humanity on the face of the globe. This is of paramount importance. It's the mothers of the world who have failed. It is the fathers of the world who have failed. And continue to fail. And the bulk of the adults of the world are parents. Now, as the child grows up, it will naturally ask all kinds of questions. The child's whole being is a being of tremendous curiosity, a mighty question mark. What is this? How? Why? The questions that children are constantly pouring out. I remember to this day how I pestered my mother with all these questions. What is this? How? Why? And so forth. And then one has to beware. The tendency of the best intentioned, the best educated fathers and mothers in the world is to enclose that child's mind in a prison house of fixed concepts. The moralities which are imposed are fixations. The conceptions which are presented to answer the ordinary questions of curiosity are also fixations in the minds of the mothers and the fathers. And this is a task of tremendous difficulty. The parents have to be such an influence upon the child mind in the course of their conversation, their playing together, their activities together, and so forth, that the child mind somehow is helped to see for itself the answer with just a little suggestion here or a suggestion there. Just no twisting of that mind, no compulsion to conform to this, that, and the other standard of behavior. No compulsion, no twisting. And yet all the straightforward conventional moralities and commandments and so forth, one has to learn to fulfill. Not obey as a slave obeys, but to obey as the intelligent, perceptive man obeys. And remember that obedience comes from ob and audire, to hear, to listen to. If you compel the child, right, there will be a tremendous reaction energy, a hate energy, a violence energy stored up in the unconscious of the child. This unconscious is not a mysterious, ethereal something. This conscious and unconscious is the whole body itself. Every single cell is conscious and unconscious simultaneously. It's stored up in the entire psychophysical organism. It's an impress upon the living organism. So, one has to sort of draw it out. But what is it that I have to draw out of my child? Not an acceptance of my ideas or my ways of life or behavior or anything. Not a mere acceptance, a blind following. But an understanding in the deeps of the child mind that this is the best way, the loving way, the helpful way, the happy way. And this is extremely difficult. Of course, we know that. But what alternative is there? Is there any alternative which points to something better, more constructive, more healing? This is the important point. So you see, if I, the parent, myself, am gentle always, quiet in my own mind particularly, because a child is extremely sensitive to the psychical state of those around it. Extremely sensitive. It knows. It's no good telling lies to the child. So you see, it is this living influence of the living parent which is the supreme educator, the one that draws out the child's own uniqueness, which will manifest in terms of, if you like, the conventional decencies, good behavior, charm, friendliness, everything. The external manifestation will have forms which are well known, but the inwards, the inner spirit will be something absolutely unique to that child. And this is the great thing. So the child grows happily, in the true sense of the term. Physically, psychologically, and in terms of insight, natural insight. So that, whilst its outward expressions will show so many signs of conformity with what has been taught throughout the ages, the inward uniqueness will shine through that external conformity and be a real asset to humanity and a source of complete, in fact, the actual expression of true fruition for that child itself. So now this, the field of the home, the family, is the starting point. Where else can we start but at home? There is no other place to start. And when we, as we ordinarily say, proceed outside, go out into the world and so forth, where are we going out into? Our home, somewhat extended, somewhat expanded. What is my true home in terms of manifested existence? Wheresoever I am, my home is here where I'm sitting at the moment. If I'm on the planet Jupiter, well, that would be my home, wouldn't it? For the time being. Wheresoever the living person is, the environment which holds him is his home, provided he is so awake and in such right relationship with that environment that he is at home in it. My very first home as an individual in my own rights is my own psychophysical organism. I have to be at home in it. And if I'm at home, it means I'm at ease. It means that I'm harmonious, that I am healthy, in the true sense of the term healthy. Not the acquired health through athletics or physical fitness exercises or all that sort of thing. Merely that sort of thing. They will all play their part, yes, because that's all part of the game of life. But let it be in proportion, in due proportion, in due measure. Then it is all right. Now this is something we really must lay the greatest emphasis, upon which we must lay the greatest emphasis. The disruption of the home, the disruption of the man-wife relationship, the parent-child relationship, is the root, is the very root of the disruption of the external conditions of life in terms of politics, economics, organizations concerned with education, with social activities, I mean in terms of social benefits and all that kind of thing. So you see, fairly and squarely, upon one's own individual shoulders, rests the responsibility for the whole world's situation. If oneself is pure in mind and heart, simple, clean living, wholesome, content with little, living in decent austerity, in decent austerity. You see? Happy, silent, quiet. That person, every moment of his life, he's so influencing his environment that like the sun sustaining the earth, he sustains and heals the world in which he lives.